This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
All right, the time is 12 minutes past the hour of 10 o'clock. Thank you very much to the news teams. We're going to speak to one of our faves, Dr. TK Boy, who is a political analyst and a lecturer at Wits University. He can be quite spicy, but always, always thorough and accurate. Nice to talk to you again, Doc.
Morning, and thanks. I'm not sure about the accurate part, but I'll take it.
No, very accurate. The spicy was the many are not making it to Parliament. They must go and apply for the 350 Nisi Lenin.
Yeah, I did say that.
You did. Okay, let's move along and let's talk about the news making headlines. So obviously, close on to 10 p.m. yesterday, the president finally arrived and made the announcements. I don't know whether the news is the cabinet itself or the fact that the president's developing a really nasty habit of being late.
Yeah, I think probably that's the one. I seem to remember someone tweeting that. I think one of the first lines when he first came in as ANC president, he stated was, "This thing of us being late, starting things late is not good."
Yeah,
but I think it's kind of degenerate to that level. Maybe it's showing the complexity of the job or the indecision. But I think it is really not good. Because, look, in as much as we do understand that there are things he was playing around with,
yeah,
one of the key things, and I think David Panyata Lusufi, he wasn't aiming it at the president. He was just saying that, look, sometimes you just need to make a decision and live with it.
So do you think the lateness of the announcement, because he was very late, I mean, it was about 45 minutes late. Do you think it has something to do with the last minute wrangling, that he probably was sitting with a few lists? He had ideas by midday, but by 6 o'clock, four calls were coming through. He was sitting with ANC negotiators, because we forget that, you know, on paper, it says the cabinet serves at the behest of the president, or it's the prerogative of the president. But actually, a lot of those negotiators are sitting there saying, don't forget what we've done for you. And the ANC negotiators and the top six would be sitting there saying, don't forget our cadres.
No, that's exactly it. But then I think experience should have told him. Because remember, the ANC is quite unique in that, remember, often by itself, it's already a coalition. If you put in the SACP, if you put in COSATU. So this has been done before. Maybe it's a bit more complicated because there's less of the cake. Well, the cake has been expanded in a bizarre way, but I think it's not new. And my thinking would have, that's why I said, look, at the end of the day, I think in decision, he probably would have known what he wants to do, give or take, listening to a few people. But at the end of the day, he should have probably made the decision to say, look, if I'm speaking at 9, and everything else could be sorted. Or he could have even managed it to say, listen, I'm only going to be introducing the team of the cabinet, which is formally just ministers, and then the next day via the normal outlets, deputy ministers would have been introduced.
Okay. But in any case, so we're nitpicking, but let's get into it. So the cabinet deal, the story in the headlines was it's almost sealed. So that was during the day Sunday. By the evening, it definitely was sealed. But what we do know is what the newspapers were telling us is that latterly, the EFF tried to sign the letter of intent to join the GNU. They had a few conditions, such as no participation by the DA or the Freedom Front Plus. MK were also told were ready to sign a letter of intent, but it all happened in the last 72 hours, it appears. And by then, the horse had bolted, I guess.
Yes, and look, while it's, I think if anything, it kind of proves that maybe there is a magnetism to having what I term a grand coalition, not really a GNU. But I think it also just maybe does raise more questions about the opposition, namely the EFF, and if MK really did entertain this, because it's not really a good look for its members. Because if you're a member or a voter of both these parties, you then do start to ask questions to say, but listen, you... When the results were announced, he took a certain position saying, this is what we're sticking to. But if you seem flexible or quite flexible at the 18th hour, it's not really great for saying, listen, that you are on a principled stance. So I think that's probably a bit problematic for their voters. But maybe, as I said, it does show that there's a magnetism towards this grand coalition. And it will be interesting to see what history will say about whether it was a good decision or it wasn't.
Okay, so strategically, I mean, many people have questioned the EFF and the MKs, saying, as you're saying, if you don't want to participate and you don't believe in a GNU, you can't at the last minute suddenly believe in it, then want to sign this letter of intent and then have conditions. You're late in coming to the game. Have you, what would the term be? Have you let your supporters down?
I think, let's speak specifically to MKs, especially as it relates to KZN. I think they did not play themselves well in KZN. They really could have sewn it up a bit earlier, but they were more interested in, I think, court process. So for them, I think there's been a bit of a letdown. And being in KZN and speaking to a few, just a normal average citizen, there is that feeling that, look, MK could have done better, could have maybe compromised a bit better in trying to seal up KZN. Nationally, I don't think its members had an expectation that they would get anything. Mm. Their core concern was getting a province to show that, look, we're not only here, but we can actually govern.
Right.
The EFF's position, I think, was really, I think, was blighted by the fact that they went in reverse at the election. So it looked as though it was begging more than anything else, and that they just took maybe wrong strategic conditions. Because
right.
for you to be able to say, listen, we don't want the DN, the Freedom Front Plus, they're in a position of power. They're already in the tent and they cannot be kicked out at the 11th hour.
Right.
So for them, I think it was more of a strategic mistake. For the MK, the mistake came in how they failed to handle KZN. So both supporters, I think, do have reason to be a bit concerned about that.
Okay, so before we move on, there's two issues here. Numerically now, because the DA and ANC are now part of a grand coalition GNU, the third largest party is MK, which technically now makes them the largest opposition party in Parliament. And it's interesting because former Justice Dr. John Hlophe is now their chief whip. So there's a lot going on in this story. But effectively, MK is now the opposition in this government.
Yes, they're now the official opposition, and if I check correctly, that title does actually exist and does actually come with a bit of a benefit. I think there's a bump up to 1 point something, because it's an actual position that exists, because the DA is no longer at the opposition benches. So even the orientation of how the House sits is different. The parties, the DA, moves now to the government benches. So the official opposition in South Africa is MK. And yeah, so I think that really does raise, I think it was a good move on their part to include someone like the former justice, because, I mean, he's quite erudite and understands probably the legal processes better than most people who are new. But again, look, politics doesn't matter how smart you are. Politics has an ability to make everybody look foolish. So it'll be interesting to see how he navigates being the official leader of the opposition party in South Africa.
Okay, and then my final question on everybody still working around the semantics, grand coalition, GNU, it doesn't really matter at this stage. But what does matter is what voters decided that 29th day of May. And if voters decided ANC at 40%, DA at 22%, MK at 13%, then what? EFF, then IFP, and then we start working down the ladder. Shouldn't any composition of a government reflect that reality, reflect how people voted? That the majority of people still believe in an ANC. There's a big chunk of that majority who still believe in a DA. There's a substantial number of people who believe in an MK. There's a good number that believe in the EFF. And really, if you're going to talk will of the people, a coalition had to incorporate some of these people regardless of their ideological differences.
Yes, and I guess this is where it becomes more technical, and I probably take the technical side and say, listen, in the absence of legislation, I know how we've tried to interpret it is to say, listen, we take a composition of the numbers and we add them up. But as far as the numbers and the law of South Africa goes, no one got 50 plus one.
Yeah.
Therefore, what we really have is that's why I use the term a grand coalition, not a government of national unity.
Mm.
And because to have a government of national unity would speak to what you're saying, namely that there must be representation of the third largest party in the country, the MK, but that's not the case. And that the parties like the EFF should have been included, but that's not the case. So this grand coalition, I think, makes it an easier preposition to understand, because it's an admission that, listen, none of the parties were able to really go through the muster of 50 plus one. Therefore, this arrangement is only about a political rather than a legal arrangement. Right. And I think in that sense, it makes sense that we can then interpret it simply as a political rather than a legal instrument, which is what the GNU traditionally and by literature is.
Okay, well, I guess we're still going to talk a lot about the GNU and other fora as well. Story number two in the newspapers this weekend, Pray For Us, reads this headline, a cry from South African soldiers stationed in the DRC. A lot is going on in the DRC. We do know that the United Nations peacekeeping mission has withdrawn. I don't know if they're fully withdrawn, but they were certainly scaling down. The South Africans under a SADC protocol and a bilateral were staying on. But the DRC Eastern Front is now an open flank, some people would say. And as a result, there's been a rebel attack on the South African Army outpost there. It was hit by a mortar, which is believed to be a mortar launched by the M23 rebels. They hit the logistics camp at Sake, which is northwest of Goma. And about 2,400 South Africans are stationed there. What we've also read in the past, in general, whether we're looking at the South African mission in Cabo Delgado or in the DRC, or even those who'd gone to Sudan, is there haven't been enough uniforms, equipment, or food. There've been some logistics issues in the Ministry of Defence to help out South African soldiers out there. And with all these variables, it seems as though the South African troops there are very, very vulnerable.
Yes, no, I think two points on this. One, I think, look, it is a key concern, and I think it really does speak to the deterioration of South Africa's ability to manage its national interests. And I think you, coming from the IR, international relations background, would better understand that, listen, a country's international interest is only supported by how well a country does domestically. And this I relate to the machinery. I think there's been numerous reports that have shown that, listen, that the SANDF is poorly equipped at the moment. It has not updated its machinery. It's not updated its structures. If anything, if I'm not mistaken, and I do stand to be corrected, that the Institute of Security Studies actually said we have more generals than actual soldiers. It's a bloated at the top. And I think this is where another key worry seems to be. And the hope should be, and I think there should be a retrospective understanding to say that we need to relook at what is our national interest. When the United Nations left the DRC, which is actually one of the most dangerous places for women there and children in that area, we do need to, you know, I think it's going to be a cold decision, but hopefully it will be a decision which will have the support of the AU. But I think South Africa does need to kind of sit down and say, listen, we've not done well with our soldiers. The fact that they are vulnerable, they don't have the right equipment in that area, means that we need to have a relook at our national interests. What does the DRC mean for South Africa? Not from an emotive perspective, but from a position, and I'm going to be very cold about it, from an economic perspective. And if we're saying this is a strategic asset for the South African government and its private sector to invest in, let's make sure that we support our men and women that are there. Because in the absence of you doing that, you literally are just leaving them open to the wolf.
And I guess then the question is, there's a new Minister of Defence. We should give her the benefit of the doubt. We don't know what her capacity is, but under-resourced ministry, maintenance that hasn't been done, cash-strapped, R&D that hasn't been done by Arms Corps and Danel, and then soldiers who are on the ground in peacekeeping missions, but they barely have uniforms, food, ablution facilities, let alone the guns to defend themselves. What would be the first port of call for a new Minister of Defence, do you think?
In all truth, and I think everybody would kind of hear from what you said, that you described the problem, this is a logistics and supply thing. You don't sort this out in a year. You don't sort this out in two. In fact, if anything, it's 3 years usually, and military logistics is even longer line. I think you really do need to speak to the African Union, and you need to really say, listen, other countries need to come support, because South Africa cannot simply do it. And then, as you said, the ministry has year in and year out is actually getting a declining for budget. If anything, I think they should actually start at the top. We need to really relook at streamlining it and actually look at, listen, maybe in this current juncture, what we should be asking for the SANDF is it should be maybe more specialized troops than anything else. And this is, I'm speaking from a position of being a layperson, not a military strategist. Yeah. But I think what South Africa should be doing is to have more of your special ops, and then to say, listen, how then best do we then reinvest in our army that we'll be able to, because we know that we want to be on the continent.
Yeah.
But I think we really need to look at the whole structure and making sure that it's almost being, you know, have we even started to speak about drones being developed by our industrial military complex, things like that.
Efficiency versus boots on ground. You don't always, quality over quantity is what you're saying.
Yes, and this is where I do have a bit of doubt about the minister that's come in, because everything that we're speaking about, we've kind of seen it in the Russia-Ukraine battle. We've seen even how the Chinese and the Americans are now restructuring their army. We've not even had that discussion, and you actually need an expert in that field. And I'm sorry to say that you moving from education to the military is not really going to be assisting that conversation.
Okay. But she's got a general who's her deputy. Maybe that would help. I don't know. Okay, let's move along. South Africa remains on the much talked about, much vaunted grey list. And Monaco is added and Turkey is removed. So interesting things happening here. The Financial Action Task Force, that's who they are. They said that South Africa, even though they've made great strides to meet the conditions of what it would need to be removed from the so-called grey list for financial services and money laundering, they've not met all the requirements, and as a result, they stay on the list. But other emerging markets like Turkey are off. And interestingly, one of the richest countries in the world, a tax haven, Monaco, it's now been added to the list. What's happening here?
Well, on the Monaco side, it kind of just shows that there is some level of justice in the world. Because, as you said, it is a tax haven, and that's one of the loopholes that they were worried about. Because once you're a tax haven, or they believe that, listen, you have not sufficiently closed your loophole, they worry about terrorist funding. Now, the hope, as you put it, that they're acknowledging that South Africa has done work. I seem to remember when Botswana was able to get themselves off, it took about a year, 2 years. Mm. So the hope should be in the next round, which would hopefully would be next year, that South African government and its authorities and also the financial services sector has worked to the level where they can be able to take it off. Because I'll be more worried if they were saying we had regressed and actually not paid attention to it. So it's an issue of saying it is frustrating, especially for those that work in the asset management space and the like. But the hope should be that, listen, they've said that there is improvement. Now, it should be about going back and getting firm confirmation, say, if we then do X and Y, we then be taken off the list.
If I remember, if my memory serves me well, there were 8 points that needed to be met in order to qualify to be removed. And they were struggling with about 3 of those 8. So I guess they didn't just quite get it right in this round, as you're saying.
Yes, and then, as I said, the hope then should be that they go back. And look, this is where the Ministry of Finance really does need to come in. Because really, South Africa is losing money. If anything, if you really look at what's happening geopolitically, there is a bit of a pressure being put on, especially from the, let's say, your Western-linked markets, for you to be able to better account where your money is going in and out of the country.
Absolutely. And there are many asset managers and pension funds in the world which wouldn't consider South Africa as an offshore investment base because of things like this. So if you want these investments, you've got to just clean up the system completely. Okay, President Zuma, NGO headed to global bodies to seek relief as fight over polls ratchets up. Now, obviously, President Zuma, after the election results were announced on the 2nd of June, was not happy and joined a list and a chorus of parties that believe that in some regions there were allegations of vote rigging. Not only did he launch a dispute with the IEC, but he then said he would take it to the international courts. What I find interesting is that apparently under his presidency, he removed South Africa from the SADC tribunal and other such international agencies that would have had latitude to at least try to investigate what happened in these elections. But there's no room. And ultimately, the Constitutional Court is the highest arbiter after the Electoral Court. So what do you know of this?
Well, look, again, this goes back to the first point I said, that I think while it's interesting, and we certainly do know the former president and his team always do try, I'd say, colorful ways to try and gain some level of attraction about the things that they maybe correctly find that to have wronged them. But I think it's a bit of a waste of time, as you said, because, look, the laws are quite clear in South Africa, and if this really was an issue, it would have been flagged. But the key concern seems to be your strategy versus the outcome, right? Your strategy, yes, for you to flag this would have been good. But if you're really now going to put resources behind it, I think it takes away from the work that you should be doing preparing for the, you know, what's happening in the region of KZN in the next election. Mm-hmm. So I think it should, from a strategy perspective, I would say do it, flag it. But if you're not starting to put financing, because now we're going to need to get a lot of international lawyers in, I think it really takes away from the work that you're doing.
We've run out of time, but French elections, very surprising outcomes, but not really surprising if you've been to Europe. I was in Europe all of last week, and in Austria, they've also had a far-right party winning. We saw this in the Netherlands. So there's a trend growing, and the question is, why is this trend growing, and what does it mean for France?
Well, the trend, it's almost like here in South Africa, key issues of migration or illegal migration, but obviously the far right sometimes doesn't make that distinction. And there's also the concern of, you know, structural problems. While we in South Africa, sadly, are used to the problems of the economy not working, there's many European countries, France being the second biggest economy in the EU, they're not quite used to this situation. So it's a simple thing. When people find that government and the economy is no longer working as is, yes, they try to ask key questions, and this is where the far right have sort of done well. They give an answer. Sometimes it might be a simple answer, but it's an answer which populations like, especially in France. If you move away from the metropole, which is your Paris's and your Marseille's, if you look at the more rural France, the questions about migration, the question of the fact that, listen, moving to a just energy transition, but forgetting farmers and what your economy has been built upon, it would seem as though President Macron really has he undermined his citizens there, and it's sort of coming back to bite him. And if you look at the trend, even in places like the United Kingdom with the Reform Party, which might take over from the Conservative Party as a second leading party, this is a direction that if you forget your populace and if you go with things like the just and easy transition, but you don't do it in such a way that you bring society with you, people will turn against you because there'll be people ready to take advantage of it. So what we're seeing in France is simply just it playing out. It just so happens that the second largest economy in the European Union. And it'll be interesting to see now how they now want to have relations with the African continent, because we all know France and Africa is a very unhealthy relationship.
Fraught. And it's almost collapsed. In fact, French Afrique had to be cancelled. But thank you so much, Dr. TK Boe, for your inputs. He's a political analyst and lecturer at Wits University. News time.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.